Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
So to be clear here, export demand would be, you know, the demand of foreign buyers. So Japan, China, Mexico, Canada, you know, they're all major buyers of U.S. meat items. And this is putting a bow around that collective group. So not domestic, but all foreign buyers.
Kansas State livestock economist Glenn Tonser.
Foreign demand for U.S. beef was down 4.5% in February compared to February of 24. Pork was down almost 3%, and chicken was down marginally. I mean, my notes here basically flat. That's very consistent with my sort of words of caution and concern on the domestic front is, you know, there's been lots of international trade discussion. Tariffs are up for debate, and, you know, they're higher than they were for sure, and up for debate how long they're going to last and what levels. And that very likely is going to reduce international trade in aggregate and not surprisingly have this effect of reducing export demand for U.S. meat.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I'm honored to be in the presence of two great men from West Texas and to be have a little slice of God's country right here in the nation's capital. And so I give a hearty welcome to fourth-generation farmer Mr. Brian Baker and Mr. John Rowley, who is a successful car dealer. Both of them love this country. Both of them are proud rural Americans, but they're on different sides of this issue, Madam Chair.
Chairman of the Budget Committee in Washington, D.C., Representative Jody Arrington from West Texas, talking about the Fish and Wildlife Service intent to expand the Muleshoe, Texas Wildlife Refuge.
And that's healthy. I mean, this is what this process is all for. Robust debate in this democratic process. But private property rights, I think we all would agree, is a cornerstone of our free society and central to the free enterprise system that's blessed our nation with unparalleled prosperity. Here's my point, and here's my position on this for the people of West Texas who I represent, recognizing there are different views. The federal government, as my dad would put it, needs more public land like I need another hole in my head. This 30 by 30 initiative where we somehow think it's a good idea for the federal government to own a third of the land in these great United States, after all we have witnessed and experienced over the recent years, where the levers of power in this city have been weaponized against landowners from the 1,500 miles of rivers because of some endangered species that whereby now those waters are not able to be utilized for irrigation to feed and clothe the American people. I've seen the Mexican mussel listed so that Texas couldn't put buoy barriers to defend itself when their federal government failed to do its job to provide for a common defense. I could go through a litany of grievances from waters of the U.S. and down the line where the federal government infringed, I believe, on our liberties. But as the budget chairman, we're $36 trillion in debt. We have world war levels of indebtedness. We are $2 trillion borrowing on the backs of our children every year, and we're paying now more in interest than we spend in all of national defense. And somehow, we think we need to spend more money on behalf of the taxpayers to buy up more land that we don't manage. We don't manage the land we have well, Madam Chair. And that causes problems. And so there are, as I said, a litany of reasons why I think it's a bad idea. I think our private property owners, like Mr. Rowley and everybody else, should be able to buy whatever property they want and transact how they please with their money. But I am a fiduciary of a dollar on behalf of the United States citizens from every state in the union. And I think it is, tremendously wasteful and unnecessary to use it to buy up more federal lands. So, that's my strong position. 10,000% increase in a wildlife refuge on the plains of West Texas. 10,000% increase. Like a hole in our head.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
In response to President Trump's tariff announcements, more than 100 countries have approached us, wanting to help rebalance global trade.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent speaking at the Institute of International Finance.
These countries have responded openly and positively to the president's actions to create a more balanced international system. We are engaged in meaningful discussions and look forward to talking with others. China, in particular, is in need of a rebalancing. Recent data shows the Chinese economy tilting even further away from consumption toward manufacturing. China's economic system, with growth driven by manufacturing exports, will continue to create even more serious imbalances with its trading partners if the status quo is allowed to continue. China's current economic model is built on exporting its way out of its economic troubles. It's an unsustainable model that is not only harming China, but the entire world. China needs to change. The country knows it needs to change. Everyone knows it needs to change, and we want to help it change because we need rebalancing too. China can start by moving its economy away from export overcapacity and towards supporting its own consumers and domestic demand. Such a shift would help with global rebalancing that the world desperately needs. Of course, trade is not the only factor in broader global economic imbalances. The persistent over-reliance on the United States for demand is resulting in an ever more unbalanced global economy. Some countries' policies encourage excess savings, which holds back private sector-led growth. Others keep wages artificially depressed, which also suppresses growth. These practices contribute to global dependence on U.S. demand to spur growth. They also lead to a global economy that is weaker and more vulnerable than it should be. In Europe, former ECB President Mario Draghi has identified several sources of stagnation, and he has outlined several recommendations to get the European economy back on the right track. European countries would do well to take his recommendations to heart. Europe has already taken some long overdue initial steps that I applaud. These steps create a new source of global demand and also involve Europe stepping up on the security front. I believe global economic relationships should come to reflect security partnerships. Security partners are more likely to have compatible economies structured for mutually beneficial trade. If the United States continues offering security guarantees and open markets, then our allies must step up with stronger commitments to shared defense. The initial actions from Europe on increased fiscal and defense spending are proof that the Trump administration's policies are indeed working. The Trump administration and the U.S. Treasury are committed to maintaining and expanding U.S. economic leadership in the world. This is especially true at the international financial institutions. The IMF and World Bank serve critical roles in the international system, and the Trump administration is eager to work with them so long as they can stay true to their missions. And under the status quo, they are falling short.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
2007, that was the first full year of the implementation of the Renewable Fuel Standard. We were on the front end of this biofuel era.
Texas A&M AgriLife Extension grain economist Dr. Mark Welch says weather can change the conversation.
And farmers, when they planted corn, they planted a lot more than USDA did in their model. They did a lot more than farmers said they were going to do in the survey. Man, they started planting corn that spring. They kept planting corn. Huge increase in acres. What happened in 2020? Farmers were surveyed in February of 2020 of what they were going to plant. What happened in March of 2020? The world shut down. The economy imploded for several months. And so you look at the outlook of demand and prospects of price from February, and certainly by the time you get to April, we were in a completely different market outlook. And we had a plunge in planted acres by 5 million. So my point from this would be, even though those general relationships I think will hold, they can be accentuated by changes in demand. And in 2025, if I had to point to one category that I'm worried about, and on the demand side of things, it's in that export number. A significant change in that one. Maybe it'll be better than we think it's going to be. Maybe some of these trade issues get resolved, we get relationships reestablished, or create trading, new trading opportunities out of all these negotiations. It may get better. It could get much worse. But I think that might be the demand piece that really throws, I think, a wild card into what these acres numbers, by the time we get to the acreage report at the end of June, compared to what farmers just said they were going to do, reported last week. Corn yields, USDA's throwing out 181 bushels. All-time record high. Well, last year was 179. It was a record. 2023 was 177. That was an all-time record. We fit two records in a row. Could we hit another one with a good year? I think it's entirely possible. But think about, if we're increasing acres this year to the degree we are, where are those acres going to be? We're planting more in Texas. You look across the South, and Mississippi is a state, strong increase in acres down there. How will those acres contribute to the overall national average? We may be expanding corn acres in places that may not raise the national average to the degree that we might see otherwise. So maybe a little degree of caution of plugging in a yield number, but does 181 seem within reach in a normal year? I couldn't argue with that number. It would be a tremendous number, first time ever over 180. But we'll see if we get there. One problem we have right now, look at that eastern half of the Corn Belt that's shaded as tan color. That number associated with those climate districts is the rank of the wettest or driest year since 1893 in those districts. So the driest year would be a number of 134 on that chart. 133, excuse me. So if your number is 133, this is the driest it's ever been. If your number is 1, you're the wettest you've been in 133 years. There's lots of hundreds over here in this part of the Corn Belt. Again, it's early. It's just the first part of March or April, end of March, when this slide was put together. But it does carry over some dry conditions in a significant corn-growing area that we'll need to overcome if we're going to hit that yield goal of 180 bushels per acre.
Texas A&M AgriLife Extension grain marketing economist, Dr. Mark Welch. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I invite our allies to work with us as we rebalance the international financial system, refocus the IMF and World Bank on their founding charters.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent speaking at the Institute of International Finance.
America First means we are doubling down on our engagement with the international economic system, including at the IMF and the World Bank. A more sustainable economic system will be one that better serves the interests of the United States and all the other participants in the system.
He says global rebalancing is not a new idea.
Look, I think that our move toward reordering the financial or trading system is a start. I think that today, as I reaffirm our engagement, but set up a list of core principles and back to basics for the institutions, and again, being from the private sector, we want to see results, and we want to see timelines that, as you and I were talking about backstage, global rebalancing has been a topic for more than 20 years. And it's some countries may have a 100-year perspective. We don't.
And when it comes to the nation's debt, he says it's not a revenue issue.
I think most people in this room are trained economists, and everyone knows that a trade deficit emanates from three things. External trade policies, which we are intent on addressing. And the external trade policies can be tariffs, non-tariff barriers, currency manipulation and the subsidy of state subsidy of labor and means of production. Mm-hmm. So trade, terms of trade or trade regulation is one. Two is our budget deficit. So the larger our deficit, the more it creates a demand suck, also pushes up the interest rates. And then three, the level of the dollar. The U.S., we continue to have a strong dollar policy, and the dollar will adjust based on markets. Everyone asks me, well, what does a strong dollar mean? And to me, the strong dollar means having the policies in place to the deserve capital flows and have confidence. But it doesn't mean that the price on the Bloomberg screen every day. And it also has different meanings in terms of bilateral the prices. So so it's really three-prong. But, Tim, to your question, I have talked about we did not get here quickly with the spending. The U.S. does not have a revenue problem. We have a spending problem. And I have suggested when I first met President Trump to talk about joining his campaign 2 years ago that we need to get back to a long-term sustainable budget deficit of something with a 3 in front of it, which works. We have 2% nominal growth or 2% inflation, projected 1.8% growth, which I think could be much higher if we implement our economic policies.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
First, we must make the IMF the IMF again.
What is the IMF? It's the International Monetary Fund, U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent.
The IMF's mission is to promote international monetary cooperation, facilitate the balanced growth of international trade, encourage economic growth, and discourage harmful policies like competitive exchange rate depreciation. These are crucially important functions to support the U.S. and global economies. Instead, the IMF has suffered from mission creep. The IMF was once unwavering in its mission of promoting global monetary cooperation and financial stability. Now it devotes disproportionate time and resources to work on climate change, gender, and social issues. These issues are not the IMF's mission. And the IMF's focus in these areas is crowding out its work on critical macroeconomic issues. The IMF must be a brutal truth teller and not just to some members. Today, the IMF has been whistling past the graveyard. Its 2024 external sector report was entitled Imbalances Receding. This Pollyannish outlook is symptomatic of an institution more dedicated to preserving the status quo than answering the hard questions. Here in the United States, we know we need to get our fiscal house in order. The last administration ran up the largest peacetime deficit in our nation's history. The current administration is committed to fixing this. We are open to critique, but we will not abide the IMF failing to critique the countries that most need it, principally surplus countries. In line with its core mandate, the IMF needs to call out countries like China that have pursued globally distortive policies and opaque currency practices for many decades. I also expect the IMF to call out unsustainable lending practices by certain creditor countries. The IMF should push more proactively official bilateral lenders to come to the table early to work with borrower countries to minimize periods of debt distress. The IMF must refocus its lending on addressing balance of payment problems, and its lending should be temporary. When done responsibly, IMF lending is at the very core of its contribution to the global economy. When markets fail, the IMF steps in and makes resources available. In exchange, countries implement economic reforms to resolve their balance of payments issues and support economic growth. The reforms undertaken during these programs are some of the IMF's most important contributions to a strong, sustainable, and balanced global economy. Argentina is a fitting example. I was in Argentina earlier this month to demonstrate the United States' support for the IMF efforts to help the country reset financially. Argentina deserves the IMF support because the country is making real progress toward meeting financial benchmarks. But not every country is so deserving. The IMF must hold countries accountable for implementing economic reforms, and sometimes the IMF needs to say no. The organization has no obligation to lend to countries that fail to implement reforms. Economic stability and growth should be the markers of the IMF's success, not how much money the institution lends out.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The wheat market had had enough negative news happen over the last 1 or 2 years without, again, outside the U.S. export competition. Actually, wheat available over in the Black Sea region coming into the U.S. in the last 1 or 2 years, at least parts of it, and have affected the price situation. When there is the possibility of something positive happening, I think it's kind of discounted until it actually happens.
Kansas State grain economist Dr. Dan O'Brien.
Russia had crop production problems. They're diminishing their shipments in the latter part of their marketing year. That, by rights, in a normal situation, would impact the wheat, U.S. wheat market potentially in a positive way. The value of the U.S. dollar here of late, with the economic news going back and forth as we try to decipher all that, weakening a little bit, that also would be a help. Seems that in the short run, that places like the EU, Europe, has been stepping in to fill some of those gaps. But if we were speaking with the Kansas wheat people, they would talk about some points of watchful potential optimism in the wheat market. And gosh, the timing of it would be just wonderful, because we'll be coming into a time frame when we've got lots of we'll have harvest wheat prices, probably lows. It'd be a great time to ship a whole bunch of wheat, that get it out of storage, move it out of the country, and reestablish the U.S. strength in export markets. You know, you and I, for a good long time, have been watching price ratios, key price ratios around the state. And interesting to me that when you look right now at the soybean versus corn prices that have been going on, really we've got Topeka and Salina at really a positive advantage towards, well, neutral to positive for planting soybeans over corn. And that hasn't shown up for a while. And we've got still out to the west, Garden City area, man, they're going to plant corn. That's what they're good at. Plus, that's what the ratios are showing. New crop soybeans versus corn, about a 2.05 ratio, 2.3 is neutral. And also, we've had something else come about. We've got the ratio of hard red winter wheat cash prices in the Garden City area of 473 wheat, 487 corn. So you have wheat prices less than corn, and for livestock feeders that are okay with feeding wheat, there's probably a way to save some money there with that. So some trends like that we're watching. So I guess I would not be of the type of thinker that say, woe is me, all is lost, we'll never have higher prices. Where we're sitting right now, the factors that would bring about higher prices really haven't emerged yet. So I guess we'll check back in 2 weeks, in 4 weeks, in 6 weeks, in 8 weeks, see how that story goes. But we're in the mode where right now the biggest thing that probably positive would be the weather, if it presents any problems. And one other thing, you and I have talked about the worries about U.S.-China relations, what that might do for exports. And here we hear news of late, a softening of tone between those countries, more chance to come to the table. And that's at least part of the issue that's been supportive of soybean prices here of late. So we'll see how that works itself out. So we've had strong statements about tariffs and direct challenges one way or the other on the upfront. But as things have worked out, these countries have come together, and it looks like in a lot of these cases we're heading for more of a moderated, negotiated outcome that's hopefully have more benefits for all parties.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
This time of year, all eyes are on the Midwest and the corn and soybean planting progress numbers.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey saying even with a week full of wetness, planting progress for both crops remains impressive. Per the USDA crop progress report for the period ending April 27th,
we saw a doubling of the corn planting progress during the week ending April 27th. A U.S. advance from 12 to 24% complete, and that keeps that overall number ahead of the five-year average of 22% planted, 1 point behind last year's number at this time, 25% planted on April 27th.
While for beans,
producers were able to take advantage of those open periods of weather to plant quite a few soybeans. So for the week ending April 27th, national progress sits at 18%. That is up from 8% a week ago and places that current number well ahead of the five-year average of 12% and also ahead of last year's 17%.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.